Please the court.
Joel Nichols on behalf of the appellant, James Kuhn. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Four? Okay.
Thank you. We're here asking the court to reverse the trial court's summary judgment dismissal of Mr. Kuhn's lawsuit against Snohomish County based on the statute of limitations and to remand the matter for trial. The parties agree that the limitations period begins to run when the employer communicates its final decision not to accommodate an employee. What we disagree on is when that decision or that communication occurred. Mr. Kuhn asserts that it occurred on November 2nd, 2007, when the county communicated its final intent not to consider his medical issues and affirmed its decision to terminate his employment effective August 16th, 2007.
Well, you characterize it as a final communication, but on August 2nd, 2007, when your client received letters, that seemed to be a pretty clear communication of intent to terminate. So why is November relevant at all?
Correct, Your Honor. August 2nd was a clear intent to terminate employment. However, that August 2nd communication, the two letters of discipline, the one suspending and the one terminating, made no mention of Mr. Kuhn's medical issues, no mention of accommodating disability. And the distinction is that the employer continued to engage in that interactive process, albeit through the grievance procedure, but the employer concedes it did interact with him to consider additional medical issues. And even as of November 2nd, 2007, the communication from Dr. Russian was, I'm not an occupational medical doctor. I think Mr. Kuhn would benefit from an occupational study. The employer on November 2nd said, this doesn't change our determination. And so we're affirming our decision. As of November 2nd, it was clear the employer was not going to accommodate Mr. Kuhn.
In your briefing, and I need to get a clarification, subsection C, it's on, starting on page 24, you say the trial court mistakenly focused on the termination as one actionable claim against Snohomish County instead of the ongoing discriminatory conduct of the county or its ongoing obligations to Mr. Kuhn that continued post-termination. That's a mouthful, and I don't quite understand what that has to do with accrual, which is the issue here.
Thank you, and I apologize for the confusion, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that the employer's duty to accommodate an employee with a disability can extend beyond the date of termination, and that is what we have here, and that's based on the Wheeler case and even some cases cited by the county, Albright, Hintz, Hinman. I think Hinman, the final decision was a year post-termination, so there is an ongoing duty to continue to accommodate, and the trial court erred in focusing on the date of termination and not considering.
But even if there's an ongoing duty, that is not the question. The question is, when does the cause of action accrue? And usually that means when your client would have the necessary information to commence an action. So enlighten me.
Sure. And so our position is, Your Honor, that the cause of action accrues when that final decision not to accommodate the employee is communicated. That can happen post-termination, and it's our position that that happened on November 2nd, 2007.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. And it's a jury question as to when the duty to accommodate terminates. That's under the Wheeler case. And the duty can continue beyond termination. It's also a jury question whether or not the county considered in good faith the relationship between Mr. Kuhn's medical issues, his medical conditions, and its decision not to accommodate him any further. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. You'll have 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Bladick, representing Snohomish County in this case. This is a case about following the rules and Mr. Kuhn being late to bring his claim to the courthouse. As Judge Cox noted, this is not about a continuing duty to accommodate, but when notice is received and when the statute of limitation accrues. Mr. Kuhn was operating under an accommodation plan for a number of years. The county had accommodated him extensively. The sole accommodation requested throughout all of that period and to this day is that he be excused for tardiness caused by his medical condition. And the county made it clear that it would be excused when it was related and not excused when it was not. On August 2nd of 2007, when it provided those notices with respect to these two instances of tardiness, it was giving very clear notice both of the termination and that it would not be accommodating these instances of tardiness and was imposing termination. The county is requesting that you uphold summary judgment. Now, there are two separate claims here. There is both a wrongful termination and a failure to accommodate claim. And the statute of limitation begins to run with respect to both of those claims with notice. The notice of the discharge was in the letter of in August 2nd of 2007. And the failure to accommodate was, there was notice if at the latest on August 2nd of 2007. Clearly, Mr. Kuhn is alleging that there was a series of instances where the county was not accommodating him, and at the latest instance where he was saying it was with respect to those June instances that was made clear on August 2nd of 2007. Now, the key factual aspects of this is that it's very clear that there is a no-fault tardiness policy of progressive discipline. Mr. Kuhn had to have been late six times in order to have reached the point of termination. He had been operating under accommodation plan and being excused for tardiness based on his medical condition. There was updated medical information in January of 2007 stating he had no other medical restrictions. He was able to do his job in every other way. There was no on-site accommodations, only that he would need to be excused for tardiness. When he had received discipline on four previous occasions. He was also given a pass for an instance in February of 2007 when he came in late because of his medical condition. In April of 2007, there was a specific letter from the county saying that he would be excused and placed on sick leave related to when he was late for related to his medical condition. After the first instance, the fifth instance, the first of these last two in June, he was given a preliminary results letter that stated, you haven't said anything that links this tardiness to your medical condition, and we're giving you additional time, additional few weeks, to tell us anything you want. The county was not soliciting specifically medical information. It was saying, you can tell us anything you want in the next couple of weeks, and we'll make our determination. The county waited that additional time as well as it got this indication that there would be additional medical information coming, so it waited that additional time. On August 2nd of 2007, it clearly made its decision that it was not going to be accommodating these instances of tardiness and imposed termination. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about this being an ongoing duty to accommodate. But you have to remember that this is not a medical termination case and it is not a reassignment case. At no point at any point has there been an identification of any other kind of accommodation other than excusing these instances of tardiness. This is not a case where there was a duty to accommodate some other medical condition. There was nothing about reassignment to other because of medical separation, a reassignment to some other position. That's not the facts of this case.
Are you suggesting that if those were the facts, that would have a different analysis with respect to accrual?
Well, I think that there are some cases that talk about where there's an indication that where there's a medical separation, essentially, that there's an ongoing duty. You can have essentially two different duties to accommodate, up to the point where somebody's medically separated to, in the job itself to try to allow them to do the job with or without reasonable accommodation. But if they can't do that, then there is a duty when they're separated from that position to find them another job. And that's just not this case. At no point did the county say it was separating him because of his medical condition. It was fully understood that he was able to perform his job when he arrived to do it. That's not what this case is about. I would point out a couple of very specific misreadings in the briefing. In the plaintiff's briefing, with respect to the Hintz case, talking about that that in that case there was a letter from the attorney saying accommodation doesn't apply to you a year after termination. The court said that that accrued with that notice. It accrued at the latest at that time. Plaintiff seems to read that to say that the latest communication, the last communication, is what starts the statute of limitations. But that's not what the court's saying there. It's saying it could have happened earlier. We don't have the facts in our record to show that. At the latest, it happened here, and you're finished because that was more than 3 years ago. Essentially, what the plaintiff is arguing is that by continuing to ask again in the grievance process, that having that, but that would put the plaintiff in control of when the statute of limitations begin to run by continuing to ask the question over and over again and getting something from the county saying, no, it doesn't apply. No, that doesn't matter. No, it doesn't apply. We went through a couple of steps in the grievance process, did not go through grievance arbitration. If that had happened, you know, the grievance arbitrations can take a year and a half to get through the process. And essentially the plaintiff is arguing that only at the end of that process would be able to, would the statute of limitations begin to run. Clearly at the point of notice on August 2nd of 2007, that's when he had all the facts available to him. The grievance was in fact filed within a week after that. It was on August 13th, or 2 weeks, August 13th of 2007. I'd also just point the court to one other case that's not in my briefing. It's a Seventh Circuit case that discusses many of these arguments. It's Soignier versus American Board of Plastic Surgery at 92 F3rd 547. It's a Seventh Circuit case from 1996. In that case, there was a plastic surgeon who had was taking oral boards and asked for various accommodations. And he was given some of those accommodations but not others in the board testing process. When he failed, he was given he knew he wasn't getting those accommodations for some of them at the time he took the test. When he failed, he filed an appeal and was arguing both that there was an ongoing duty to accommodate and that the appeal process was a continuing of the interactive process. And the court rejected both of those arguments, relying on the Ricks case in the same way that this court in Albright relied on Ricks with respect to an accommodation case, that it has to do with when notice was received, not when the effects became apparent or when it started to hurt.
You provided written supplemental authority of that particular case?
I have not, and I can do that.
The rules allow you to do that.
Thank you. If the court doesn't have any additional questions, I can wrap up my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, the no-fault tardiness is not contested. We don't contest that the employer has this no-fault tardiness policy, but that's not the issue. The issue is whether or not when the employer learns that the employee has a disability that needs accommodation, whether or not they've met their duty to accommodate that, to reasonably accommodate that, if they can do so without undue hardship. And in this case, Snohomish County put in abeyance its decision to consider additional medical evidence. Now, Mr. Kuhn was unable to get that additional medical evidence in the time frame that Snohomish County requested, and it was a very short time frame. But nonetheless, they did put their decision in abeyance.
Where in the record does it show that the county put its termination letter in abeyance?
They, on July 9th, 2007, there was a pre-disciplinary hearing. I have in my notes at clerk's papers 217, and also clerk's papers 188. The county informed Mr. Kuhn that no decision will be made until further information was received from his medical providers. I believe they put a deadline on that of like the end of July or something like that. He wasn't able to get it to them. He did, his sleep specialist did send them a fax on July 10th, 2007 that indicated that they needed more time. That's at clerk's papers 188. Responding to the county's argument that this is not a medical termination case, I would direct the court to the Gambini case. There is an ongoing duty, an employer has an ongoing duty to determine whether or not conduct resulting in the employee's termination is related to a disability. And if it does learn that, then it can be part of the disability and cannot be a lawful basis for terminating the employee. And so even though the employer may say this wasn't a medical termination case, we were just adhering strictly to our attendance policy. Well, really, that sort of sidesteps the issue. The issue is, did Mr. Kuhn have a disability for which the county failed to reasonably accommodate and did not fully engage in its duty to accommodate that disability?
Prior to termination, they had been aware of a condition, and they had, as I understand the record, laid out a policy whereby if he could provide evidence that his tardiness was related to his condition, that would be excused, but otherwise it wouldn't. So what else are you talking about here?
Well, he wasn't able to get sufficient medical evidence to them within the time period, the limited time period that they said that they would consider it.
But you will concede that prior to August 2nd, they were aware of this situation. They accommodated him.
They had accommodated him to a degree. Yes, they were aware of the situation.
Okay.
Under the Hintz case and the Albrecht case, clearly counsel and I have a disagreement about what those cases say. Those cases hold that the statute of limitations does not begin to run until the employer communicates its decision to the employee not to accommodate. The last thing I would like to say is that the National Railroad case that was referenced in both briefs, I would point out, was superseded by statute, by the Lilly Ledbetter law, and that's the case where the Supreme Court dismissed a race discrimination case because of timeliness issues on a discrete act and not filing with the EEOC or filing a charge within the time period of the EEOC. That case was superseded by statute in the Lilly Ledbetter law, so that a series of acts can constitute one discriminatory act, and as long as
one hostile work environment, is it not?
That's hostile work environment. That's true, but I think the same analysis applies in disability discrimination for ongoing acts of discrimination. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.